What is this gizmo that you brought me?
I brought you the Buddha machine, since the theme of today's broadcast is mistaken identities. I wanted to get something that potentially had a sort of scary music component to it that we might use for sound effects later on. So I got this online at the Forced Exposure website.
Does that mean you think of Buddha as scary?
Maybe a little bit. Maybe the Buddha nature is inherently scary.
Well, let's hear it. What does it sound like?
Okay. We've each got one here. We're about to turn them on. Maybe you want to go to sound number two, though, Mike.
Wait, is sound two with the up button or down button?
Doesn't matter.
Scary Buddha.
So anyway, this thing, it's got like 9 settings on it, and you can just turn it on and it'll go around and around. It plays the little loop indefinitely, as you can tell at this very moment.
In the Western world, we sleep to the sounds of whales and oceans. In the Eastern world, they sleep to haunting Buddha sounds. So the real reason we're here is for podcast number 2 of 1859, which is about mistaken identities. 1859. We've been alternating ideas for topics. The first topic from the prior podcast was bugs, and that was Rick's choice. This one is my choice, and the reason I thought of it was because of an incident that took place with Rick and I together in Lower Manhattan about 8 months ago.
Right. A show. We were doing a show. Where was that show again?
At
Joe's Pub.
Yeah, Joe's Pub. But we had like an hour or two to kill before the show. And sitting at St. Mark's Church on 1st Avenue and 11th Street, I believe, the two of us and our friend Fiona were all sitting around. And guy walking up to the park, Rick pointed out and said, "Oh my God, it's Geddy Lee."
Yeah, it really looked exactly like Geddy Lee.
It did. Yeah. Despite the fact it looked like Geddy Lee from 20 years ago, and not maybe current-day Geddy Lee, but I don't really even know what current-day Geddy Lee looks like. For those of you who don't know, Geddy Lee is the bass player and lead singer for the band Rush.
I didn't actually know that, Mike.
But you knew what he looked like.
I repudiate any knowledge of Rush. I have no knowledge of Rush.
Yet amazingly, you knew this guy was Geddy Lee. 1859. So the three of us are sitting out in this park, and Geddy Lee's there. And then who should pull up on his bike next to Geddy Lee? But
Alex Lifeson, is that the guy's name?
The lead guitar player? The guitar player for Rush. Here we are, we're positive now it's Geddy Lee and Alex, whatever his name is, from Rush. And we thought Neil Peart showed up, who was the whole, triumvirate.
Do you want to say triumvirate?
Yeah, maybe I do.
1859. I mean, it did seem weird to me that Geddy Lee was standing in front of the St. Mark's Church. Like,
well, you pointed out, you said you thought he probably just wanted to be noticed. You thought he was kind of standing there hoping to be noticed, which it did look like. He was like, "Hi, I'm Geddy Lee. Someone come talk to me."
Yeah, so naturally, you're the gregarious member of the outfit. I mean,
well, Fiona kind of volunteered to do it, but then she chickened out, went back and forth, and finally it's like, I'll do it. So I approached Geddy Lee.
Wait, before you go any further, I just want to say that like the next 2 minutes were excruciating.
Fiona
and I were sitting there, we're like, "Oh my God, he's having an entire conversation with Geddy Lee," and it went on and on and on. And I thought like you were getting Geddy Lee to come play on the show or something. It was astonishing how long the conversation seemed.
Right. So you thought he was gonna play bass at the show that night. But in fact, I went up to him and said, "Hi, it's great to see you here in New York." And he went, "Oh, thanks." And it already seemed a little off already just right there and then, but I figured it was fine. I was feeling a little stupid and nervous, but I continued and said, "So do you live here? I thought you guys were in Canada." He went, "Huh? No, we live here." And I kind of looked at him confused, and he looked at me confused. And he said, "Wait, you think I'm that guy from Rush, don't you? And I said, well, yes, actually, I did think you were that guy from Rush. And he goes, oh, no, I get that a lot. But that's cool. And I said, oh, well, I feel silly now. You do play in a band, though? And he said, yeah, we play in, you know, some, he told me the name of the band, and I think he even
Rush Tribute Band?
Something, yeah, right. Limelight.
2112.
YYZ. But this is the best part, is I came back and I told you and Fiona what had just happened, and you guys didn't believe it. You were so sure it was Geddy Lee. You were like, no, that's him, and he's just pretending. He just didn't want to deal with the fact that he was busted or whatever.
I think that's true. I still kind of believe that. Actually.
You still think it's Geddy Lee?
I think it was Geddy Lee, yeah.
Well, to continue with our antics on 1859, I think it's time we call some people up and get them to tell their stories of mistaken identities. 1859. Okay, so we're here with Sean Irons, who has a story for us. Sean, tell us your mistaken identity story.
Yeah, I was in a play with a theater company called the Wooster Group, and some years ago we were embarking on a summer-long tour of Europe, a bunch of places, and I believe we were flying to Vienna. And so I was leaving on the day of the cast, the whole cast, kind of meeting at JFK, and happened to be in line behind Willem Dafoe, the actor who played the lead role in the play, the Harry Yates, Eugene O'Neill play, and so he kind of quickly made arrangements for us to sit together, so mainly because he said whenever he sits on planes, people recognize him or often recognize him. His face is pretty recognizable in that ancient Viking way, and they want to make chit-chat with him, small talk, and we were taking our seats, and he was back, and I was kind of shocked to see that he wasn't flying first class. And he's like, no, solidarity, brother, you know, this is the Wooster Group, we stick together. And although I heard rumors that other tours he did, in fact, switch at the last second his seat to first class. We took our seats, and people were shifting around, and I noticed after a while that the stewardess, in particular, was really kind of eyeing us, but mostly me, and several times she passed by and gave a little wave, and one was like, that's odd, I wonder who she thinks we are. And then finally, when she was serving the drinks, I think she said, you are famous, aren't you? And Willem kind of went to nod, but then clearly it was understood that she was looking and talking to me, and then she left, and I just kind of half nodded or didn't say anything because I assumed she was talking to Willem and didn't understand what she was looking at me. I forget how she first mentioned it, but it did become clear that she thought it was, in fact, Michael Stipe because I had a shaved head and a little facial hair and a similar shaped face. I've been told that in the past.
Well, you did an impression of Willem Dafoe that I really like.
Oh, yeah. Even though he didn't want to be recognized in chit-chat, he did seem kind of taken aback that I was the one being recognized as someone famous. And he's like, I can't believe it. You know, I have you sitting next to me, Shawnee. And they think, yeah, the famous guy.
1859. Next up is my friend Nina Kachadorian. Nina, you have a good story about mistaken identity?
I know this guy who's a plastic surgeon, sort of a fancy Fifth Avenue office plastic surgeon. And he was once having a birthday roll around, and his secretary, this woman Sarah, who's this incredibly nice woman, decided to arrange a sort of surprise birthday party for him. So she called up a bunch of the friends of his that she knew, and also the friends of his who had been former patients, and he kind of tends to stay friends with a lot of his former patients. So we all showed up in surprise birthday party mode, kind of stealthily at his office, and it was kind of an awkward gathering because, you know, we didn't really know who was a friend and who was a former patient and where the overlap was, so everyone was kind of standing around and looking at each other and trying to see if everything was, you know, natural or not, and it kind of created a strange mood as we stood around waiting for him to arrive. And as people were trickling in, I was sort of sitting waiting, and in through the door walked Rod Stewart, which was extremely surprising to me because my plastic surgeon friend tends to brag a little bit about the people who are famous who he works on, and this had never been mentioned. So I was completely taken aback. it became even more awkward. And to add to the already super awkward atmosphere, the radio in the office began playing a Rod Stewart song. So I just didn't know what to do at that point. It was very weird. And I kind of sidled up to Sarah, the secretary, and said, Sarah, you know, this is really strange. I never knew that, you know, Rod was one of the patients here. Like, what's he had done, you know? And she said, oh, no, it's not Rod. That's Rod's double, Carmine. and I said, what? And she said, yeah, he works for Rod. He's really nice. And immediately kind of yanked me over there and introduced me. And this guy, Carmine, who, you know, I mean, the minute he opened his mouth, he had this, like, high, raspy kind of New York voice, like he sounded nothing like Rod Stewart at all. And he was unbelievable. He was this totally sweet guy from Queens and had worked for Rod Stewart for 15 years or more, and they were good pals and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, he was like part of the Rod Stewart business. So it wasn't him at all, but he was extremely passable, I've got to say.
Now we're going to call our French friend Olivier Conan.
1859.
I'm not going to say anything this time. I'm not going to make a fool out of myself.
What?
No mistaken identity. I know who I am every single time. I wake up every morning and I know this is me. He's me.
You don't have a single story at all?
It's not a single one, no. Nothing. I have nothing to say. I don't know you.
1859. And now Fiona Mazzell.
Me and my mom and my brother and I used to live at this house in Richfield, Connecticut on Rainbow Lake. And because there were three of us, so it was called Triple P for Triple Paradise, because there were three of us and all three of us were in paradise. Anyway, we used to have this Jeep, this white Cherokee Chief Jeep, and my mom, who's possibly one of the worst drivers ever, very insecure, you know, would take us back and forth every weekend. So one day we were coming back on a Sunday back to the city from Triple P, Richfield, Connecticut. And we're on the FDR Drive coming back to the city, and FDR is even, like, in worse shape than it is now. And I look over to my left outside of the window, and who do I see but Heavy D in his white low-rider Cadillac with a bunch of his cohorts. And he had a big hit song, a number one song out. The song went, girls, they girls, they love me. And then the chorus was, he's an overweight, love a Heavy D. So anyway, I got very excited, and my mom, who is Israeli and clueless, which is a good combination, I guess, doesn't know anything, you know, about pop culture, music, nothing. She's a concert pianist, classical music, and all that. And it's like, Mom, you know, it's Heavy D right next to us. And she got very excited, and she sped up the car to pull up next to him, and she rolled down her window and, you know, gestured for him to do the same, which he did, and he looked at this crazy Israeli, and she was like, excuse me, are you a Heavy D? Because she, you know, she needed an article because she thought it was like a descriptive. In any case, I was completely mortified, and my brother didn't understand anything because he, too, doesn't know. He lives under a rock. And my mom, because she was so vexed and confused about what was happening, did not notice that all the cars in front of us had come to a halt, at which point we slammed into this line of cars, and the Heavy D's white Cadillac just kind of sped off.
1859.
All right, let's get my friend Johnny Hot, who lives in Richmond, Virginia, on the phone.
Once I ran out of a restaurant, I went to the car to get a washboard, and I ran out really fast. Had to be back in a second. I saw this really huge African-American man standing on the corner with his back towards me, and I thought I knew him. So when I went by, I kind of gave him a little tap on the butt, a little love tap, thinking that I knew him, a guy that used to come in there all the time. Anyway, so he turned around, and it wasn't him, and I didn't know him.
Well, you need to preempt this by, right, as of now, it sounds like you were doing laundry for the restaurant.
That's right.
Going out to get your washboard.
No, I was on a gig.
At a restaurant.
And they were still, I had to go and get my washboard out of the car. And you edit all that.
1859. And the final story on this episode of 1859 is from Miranda July.
This happened time in the mid-90s when I was living in Portland. And I wasn't famous, but I was famous enough to occasionally get a little bit of fan mail from people I didn't know. And I got a box in the mail, and when I opened the box, it was a bouquet of dried flowers. like something that, you know, like a mom would have. Like it was sort of dusty, and it was from this medical student in somewhere in the Midwest, and he said that, you know, this album of mine called the B'nai Simon Test had, like, you know, was the only thing that had kept him sane in medical school. And he proceeded to send me a bunch of letters, long letters and cards and stuff. And then he sent one that said he was going on the first vacation of his life and he was coming to Portland to meet me. And I hadn't written back to any of these. And he included in that letter, like, a picture of himself. He looked kind of like a nerdier version of Harold from Harold and Maude. Like, if Harold wasn't actually cool. And also a calling card and a list of numbers of his friends so I could call them to check him out and make sure he was, you know, an okay guy. Also a list of restaurants in Portland that he'd researched. and I just didn't respond, you know. A few weeks later, like 3 weeks later, I got an email saying, "Where's Stephen? He went out to visit you a few weeks ago, and we haven't heard from him, and we know he's with you." And I wrote back saying, you know, "No, I don't know him. I've never written back, and I, you know, he's definitely not with me." And then I started to get emails from, like, family members of his, and then I got an email from a detective who was looking for him. And to everyone, I said the same thing, which is just, you know, what I told you. I got these letters, and everyone was really, like, suspicious, or maybe it was just that I was the only link they had. No one could believe that I was just a dead end. And then the local paper caught wind of it, and then they were trying to talk to me and sort of, you know, it's like amateur detective or sort of tabloid-like, and I refused to talk to them. But nonetheless, an article came out, which flipped the front page of the weekly. It said, "Without a trace." I read it because I was curious. It turned out that he had come. He had made it to Portland, basically, and he had taken a day hike. He had checked out for a day hike on Mount Hood, and that was the last evidence that anyone had seen of him. And I guess they searched the area extensively, but it seemed unlikely that he wouldn't be found in that area. I don't know why. And there was a picture of me, and I was sort of painted as, like, you know, possibly a dark figure mixed up in all this. But, you know, to this day, he hasn't been found. And every few years, I get, like, an email from his mother's best friend, who I think really does believe that I'm holding out on him and that I'm protecting him and his new identity. And, you know, but I'm not. And I guess his mom, you know, it's destroyed her life. I guess she's, like, heavily medicated.
"1859" was produced by Michael Hurst and Rick Moody, and we'd like to thank the voices from this episode: Sean Irons, Nina Cacciadorian, Olivier Conan, Fiona Mazzell, Johnny Hott, and Miranda July.